Welcome. My name is Maxwell Glonard-Eshwood. I'm sat down today with Nick Mabey and John Richardson.
G'day, Max.
G'day, Nick.
Hello, Max. Hello, Nick.
Hello, John.
Welcome both. I think it'd be great for listeners if you could just give us a brief rundown of who you are and what you do in coffee.
Sure, do you want to start with John?
I will go first then, yes. I've kind of been in the industry for about 25 years, for about 15 years as an owner and operator of coffee shops and a lot of other hospitality businesses. I've been consulting for the last 12 years. And what I do is basically try to help people to make more money in their coffee shops. I don't help them with the coffee part of it, but I help them with the profitability aspect of it. I've written a number of books on how to run coffee shops. I do a lot of speaking, a lot of work with cafe culture over the years. But yeah, what I focus on is helping people to actually make profit at the end of the day from that cup of coffee or that delicious bun that they make.
Yeah, 100%. I think we all got involved in cafe culture because, you know, you recognize coffee is both this, you know, fascinating product, a community, but also an industry.
Sure.
And ultimately, you can't explore how interesting coffee is unless you're making money from
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Yeah. How about yourself, Nick?
Yeah, good point, Max. Do you still own the shops, John?
No, not anymore. I haven't owned anything for about 12 years.
Oh, okay. We'll get to that, I suppose. I've been in coffee for, well, I just had to kind of say, I don't really count my barista years as being in coffee because I really didn't know what was going on.
Count them. Makes it sound better.
Yeah, well, I live in New Zealand, obviously. I'm a musician, moved to New York and then got really into coffee when I moved to London. And I founded a company called Assembly Coffee under the wing of Volcano Coffee Works, and here we are.
And when was that? How long has Assembly been going?
2014. We started dreaming it up, and 15 was the launch at London Coffee Festival.
Got it.
My role day to day is sourcing, essentially.
And the green coffee side of the business.
Exactly, yeah.
And when you say relationships, you mean those supply chain relationships or also customer facing?
Well, a bit of both, but generally speaking, my obligation is all backwards, supply chain south, we call it. So sourcing.
I see, yeah, yeah.
Exporters, importers, producer groups, blah, blah, blah.
Interesting. And so do you feel that that's been a particular challenge that Assembly's needed to address as a business? Did you feel, you know, for me, I think it's interesting that you go back 20 years in coffee and
yeah.
there was quite a few prominent businesses, especially in the United States, who were saying, okay, this supply chain's difficult. We need to take control of it. We need to go direct ourselves. And obviously, it's a lot more open now. It's much easier to trace coffee and get hold of transparent coffee.
Yeah.
So is it for you about, is a lot of your work around story, or is it the commercials as well of
it's all commercially driven. Mm-hmm. But I think outwardly, we don't necessarily talk about transparency in terms of campaigns or anything. I think businesses are responsible for giving people a reason to pay for coffee, right? And whatever message you need to tell in order to make that happen, then do it. But as long as it's sincere, right? But my fascination, it's all very self-serving, I think, because my fascination with industry isn't about the coffee, it's about the supply chain, it's about the people, you know?
Yeah, sure.
So it's all driven by that. And I think generally, if I try and define what specialty coffee is, it's often my kind of go-to response is a network of businesses that choose to participate in an alternative supply chain, period. And everything else apart from that is just a happy bonus.
Yeah, sure.
Do you know what I mean?
No, absolutely. I mean, trying to define specialty is really, really difficult. It's getting harder and harder. I think there's a big blur, basically, between the sort of boutique end of the industry and the mainstream.
Exactly. And I don't even know if it's as relevant anymore, but it probably is. But basically, if you do want to understand how the supply chain can be virtuous or, you know, can offer better results for, you know, all the stakeholders, producers, whatsoever, then you kind of have to understand why and if it might be broken in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. And I presume, you know, each country you're working with has different challenges.
Well, that's one of the things. Every country requires a completely unique
approach,
yeah. Right? And it's generally just about managing the relationship.
Does that encourage you at Assembly to think about working with less origins so you can really focus on the challenges of those individual challenges? Or
absolutely, you kind of have to focus your buying power. For one, I'm quite lucky because I'm buying for Volcano as well, so, and that's more ethical driven really, because it's more commercial, I suppose. The audience is less coffee focused, it's more
so it's brand for the loyalty. Brand of Volcano is a big part of, you know, if you were to list why customers buy Volcano, you're saying that the supply chain and the transparency of that is actually quite high there.
Yes,
whereas yeah. with Assembly it's more about cup quality.
Generally speaking, yeah, or whatever it might be, the added value that we provide in terms of marketing or whatever, or the, you know, the insight that we provide just by being who we are.
Yeah, and ultimately, if you know, there's no farm that just produces high quality coffee, right? If you take one tree, there's no way that every bean on that tree is
Well, that's the thing. I think one of the challenges is if you are going to differentiate against non-specialty, what does that actually look like?
Yeah.
You know, and the biggest challenge is actually giving a consumers a concise message that correlates to cup quality. But generally speaking, their quality perception is different kind of cues rather than what's in the cup, because it is fundamentally acquired taste coffee, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. And so, you know, topics like this are rabbit holes, effectively.
I think we've just proven that point, yeah.
we just dipped our feet in. But yeah. Obviously you're going to be at Cafe Culture talking about supply chain.
Yeah, well, I've been curating the program with you. So one of the focuses there is there's a lot of supply chain focus. I think it's certainly a relevant topic. There's a lot more information out there now. People are much more aware of the market forces than they were 5 years ago, right? People are talking about FOB prices. What does that mean? People are talking about the C price. What does that mean? They're talking about futures and the role of speculators and providing that down force. So there's a lot of talkers coming in with a perspective on that, like Richard Williams from Falcon, who's a brilliant trader. Corey Bush from 32 Cups is going to be around. And Andrea Otter from Twin, who's a fair trade specialist, which is also very exciting to hear, because that kind of cops a lot of slack.
It does, yeah.
For various reasons, right? And I will be talking specifically about mitigating Brexit.
Okay.
Yeah, from a very uninformed perspective.
Great.
Which I think is relevant.
Well, I'll be there for that talk.
Good.
But effectively, I think that's a good, you know, you've sort of given a bit of an outline about the program that we're putting together for Cafe Culture.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'd just like to touch on why we all sort of came together.
Sure.
To sort of take the opportunity to, you know, effectively evolve Cafe Culture and put a stake in the ground and go, okay, what does the coffee industry need now?
Yes.
And how can we build a show around the businesses in coffee and what they need? Because the coffee industry is fast moving, it's changing all of the time. But also a lot of these businesses that started off as passion projects, you know, they've evolved into small, medium enterprises, you know, sometimes bigger businesses. And, you know, that, you know, we all, I think, there's a lot of people in coffee who, there's lots we don't understand, but we know we need to understand it as a business owner, which is really the inspiration for all of the programs, right?
Yeah, I mean, and this is where John comes in, I think. It's really about, I mean, it was almost kind of frowned upon to be profitable at one point, because it was such a passion-led industry, yeah. Right? And compromising quality seemed to be the only way to be scalable, but obviously that's not true.
Yeah, I mean, I think this industry is still incredibly filled with people that started up as passion projects, you know, at all sorts of different aspects of it. I think it's... I don't quite know why that is the case, but you're absolutely right. There are lots of people still out there deciding to get into it in various forms, and not just necessarily opening a coffee shop, maybe opening up a roastery. And as long as they can be part of that whole lovely culture, they genuinely say things like, I don't really care if I make any profit, as long as I can just replace sort of vaguely what I was earning before. And then they realize, well, actually, they've paid for a lot of stuff. Exactly. But they have a huge lease, you know. They've had to buy a lot of equipment, and then they've got staff, and they've got all of those things. And there's an awful lot of people coming in a passionate way, and then really struggling to understand, well, actually, you buy this for X, you have to sell it for Y, and there's going to be something in there for you.
Do the people who come into it that way that you've met throughout your career, did they tend to be an employee that then you quit that job and wanted to be a business owner and saw coffee as an opportunity to take that step? And or
there are lots of different types of that. There are certainly people coming in. I mean, if you talk about Nick, you coming in sort of via being a barista, there's an awful lot of that people are sitting there working for somebody else. And then to an extent, maybe they end up going and working for somebody like Peter Dorsmith and Caffeine, who's very good at helping people to set up coffee shops off the back of that. So you've got a lot of those people, but you also have huge amounts of people sitting in very boring jobs, sitting behind a desk, hating their boss, hating what they do, but being slightly obsessed with coffee or obsessed with hospitality and the food side of it, and thinking that their dream is to go out there and open up this wonderful little coffee shop. Sure. And it'll be so lovely. And I really, really care about coffee. And I know I can do better coffee than everybody else. And I know we'll do all this stuff better. And then they maybe get made redundant or whatever. They get some money together. They remortgage the house, although that's harder these days. And out they go, and suddenly they realize they've got this full-blown business.
When do people come across you in their journey? At every point? Or do you find that people have done 6 months, gone, my goodness, this is harder than I thought?
There's a couple of different times. Often people will have read, they'll have done that little piece of a first piece of research where they'll read a few books, and I've got a couple of books that are basically on how to set up coffee shops. So they'll spend that little bit of money and read a few books, and then they'll speak maybe to their, who their coffee supplier, and they'll, you know, they'll maybe speak to somebody, local council or whatever, and get some information. Then they'll either, they come across me generally after that, a Facebook group of over 1,000 people that own cafes and coffee shops. So they have a mailing list as well. So I sort of send stuff out on a regular basis. Mm. But sometimes you meet people 18 months in, and this is really common. And because of the odd cash flow implications of running a coffee shop, you don't have to pay your VAT for 3 months. You know, you're often not paying your rent for 3 months. You know, when you may be paying your suppliers 30 days on down the line, you can go quite a long way before you realize.
18 months is a long time, yeah.
You can go a long way before you're in real trouble. And I meet a few of them at the 18-month zone, and they are hundreds of thousands of pounds the wrong way.
Is it because they don't understand their own P&L, or are they struggling to capture an audience?
I hate to say it, it's because they don't understand the P&L.
Yeah.
They literally just think, if I put out delicious coffee and delicious food and make sure that my people look after the customers well, and there's some sales there, surely there'll be a bit at the end for me.
That's the common theme. Eh? I mean, people assume getting into it that if they can deliver, if they can just deliver on what they believe is
that's right.
Quality.
Yeah, it's kind of it's
on this passionate thing that they wanted itself, to create.
Right? Well, I think one of the traps of the industry is that we think that we're just selling a product. We're really fulfilling a needs state.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, it's kind of sad, but
kind of true, right?
It's very true. I think, you know, I've said that to my, when I, you know, because obviously with my first shop, I worked on the shop floor 7 days a week, which was actually going to be my question for you, John, which is those people, how many of them do work in business on the floor?
Well, again, it falls into a couple of different categories. Some of them do, but I mean, I do quite a lot of work with small chains trying to turn themselves into bigger chains to them.
Yeah. Well, of course, they wouldn't work on the floor.
And they don't. But then you have a number of people out there. There are different levels of that. So if you're working the 7 days a week on the floor, you leave yourself so open to a business going bust if you break your leg. Or, you just get sick or something happens. Mm. And there's a lot of that in terms of trying to help those people put systems in place so that they can at least step by. And one of the first things I do when we do any consultancy work is I get them to get a score on where their lifestyle is with it. Now, some people want to be on the floor or they want to just do 3 or 4 hours a day and they still get that real buzz from it. But and those are mostly the people that I work with. But I have a new client this week, and we do this score of 0 to 10 in terms of his lifestyle. And his score is 0 because he's there 6 in the morning, sometimes till 11 at night. Mm. And actually, then there's no joy. They don't treat their staff well. The standards go down because they're just exhausted. And again, you come back to that 18-month period of time. They're exhausted and they're running out of money. So they almost, a lot of those people actually, it's so difficult to pull themselves back up again.
Mm.
So do you think there's a formula? Is what's changed in the last 10 years? Because I've kind of looked at the bricks and mortar stuff. Because we dabble in, you know, the idea of starting cafes.
Yeah.
You've got to pay for this, Nick.
No, well, I always just think
unless you're going to open 3 shops and within 12 months, is there a point where you get to a successful operating model when you go, right, I either have to open another one or I just accept that I've reached my limit?
My question was actually on a similar, you know, for me, my advice to a lot of people, if you're only going to have one coffee shop, if you've decided as the owner that you don't want to work in it at all,
then don't do it.
I'm like, whoa, it's going to be
really
tough.
Yeah, it's really tough. But you have to know how the thing works, or else that P&L is just going to be red the whole time.
Are most of the people you're working with categorically specialty coffee?
Do you know what? It's interesting because we talked about that blurred line of specialty coffee earlier on, and exactly what does it mean? And it's kind of weird, and people don't want to call it specialty anymore, and some people, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So I would have said when I started consulting, only 20% of my clients were specialty in any way, and now it's at least 80%. And the Hugh, who I used to work with, he used to talk about 12 years ago when we started consulting, he used to say, great quality is the price of entry. And that wasn't true. Because
it sounds good, though. I wish it were true.
It's a cracking line, but it's much, much truer now. Mm. So that, I think, is why some of this line of blurred speciality, you know, you can't, wherever you are, you know, back in the day, you'd look at the cool parts of London and think all these cool specialty coffee shops are coming together. But now they're all over the UK, and people's expectation and standards from what they want from a cup of coffee are vastly higher.
It's completely changed. Yeah, I mean, from, you know, our shop is 10 years old this year, and Our shop was a bit of a concept store.
Well, it still is, eh?
It still is. But it was much more of a concept store then, as in customers really didn't understand it 10 years ago. Sure. It was tough from a service point of view.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's got so much easier, which, of course, you know, you have a shop, you have a reputation, you build up a following and a customer base. But I really do think that 10 years ago, there was people saying, and this, I think this is, and I myself was like, I don't know, maybe it will never happen, but saying, you know, the majority of people aren't going to know what most of this means. They're not interested. And, you know, that's not true. It's actually, it's gone. I think the narrative of specialty has gone mainstream.
Yeah.
Effectively.
Well, I think it's evident most places. You only have to look at McDonald's or some of the chains to kind of see evidence of it in the language.
And a lot of the best-selling products from the multiples are coming from the independent scene, you know, the flat white. They're looking exactly at those trends.
Which is also provides a candidate, because then how do you differentiate? Yeah. Again, if it becomes so ubiquitous that like paying more for it becomes prohibitive, then, which is one of the challenges I've got as a roaster in London now, right? It is so competitive.
Yeah. Yes.
That people demand the quality, but they also demand the price. Lower price. And you know this.
Yes, I do, yeah.
I mean, my view on that, the way I believe it is difficult for you folks, you have on one side, you have Costa deciding to do a flat white and all whatever other terminology that they use and steal from speciality, as we might call it. And for a lot of the ordinary consumers, they've no idea that that person with the good independent down the road is playing probably in and around three times what they'd be paying Costa for the core for
yeah,
the beans.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
And they don't know, because as long as the milk's textured well, there are a lot of people who actually look at that and think, well, that's the same. So why should I be paying you? I mean, and maybe Costa are £2.70 for the flat white, and you're trying to get £2.80 or £2.90. Mm. Everybody's trying to, of course, break the £3 barrier.
Exactly.
Because it needs to be broken.
It does, and this is the downfalls I talk about, right? Because it is so, coffee is so broadly consumed for so many different, one main reason, right? It's a caffeine hit or whatever. And that's still very true. I think the specialty coffee thing is identified by its independent nature.
Yeah.
And independence is the fastest growing consumer kind of trigger in the world, and it has been for a while. Then at what point does the quality narrative cease to be important to the consumer? I don't even think it really has. Unless you're very niche.
I think but yeah, it's quite complex with the consumer.
And this is the point, but how do you tell your own story and get them to bypass? Because
I would argue it's a more segmented market than ever.
What do you mean?
Coffee, as in multiple propositions side by side. So millennials and Gen Z. So Coca-Cola is well known for its strategy being about having lots of different brands, understanding that not everyone is going to want the same story
the
or fill into the same
states or whatever.
Yeah. Right. That's so, right. And you know, Nestle is doing the same thing, going, oh, you know, just trying to have a market dominating brand anymore isn't going to work.
Uh-huh.
Younger people want choice. It's all tribal branding. They want differentiation.
Mm.
So, you know, finding sweeping market trends is, I think, tougher than there is trends in the market, but trying to argue they dominate the market is quite tough now.
Yeah, you're right.
I was just thinking, John, listening to everything you were saying. So at the show, what will you be offering in terms of workshops and talks?
So one of the things that I'm doing is an event, a 3-hour event, actually teaching people those core management skills, because I've done a lot of management training over the years. So that sort of came out of a need via cafe culture. Second one is a 3-hour event that we're doing on basically, it's how to improve the profitability of your coffee shop, because it's been hit so hard by core ingredient costs. You know, national living wage costs, which I believe are a good thing, but they hit those coffee shops hard because they are way above inflation.
Mm-hmm.
So your wage cost goes up, your core ingredient cost goes up, your rents are going up. In London, your rates are going up. So that whole coming back to the P&L has been hit much harder. So we have a whole session on actually what do you need to do to make sure you can still put your 10 to 15% to the bottom line.
Mm.
And then actually I'm doing another free session just on teaching startups how much money they can expect to make out of their coffee shop, because often they don't know. They're still looking in and thinking, well, that's great, that's £3 cup of coffee, that can only be costing 50p, look at all the profit. Sure. You know, and it's like that belief still exists out there amongst the general public.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's the classic sort of truth that it's very hard in, you know, for people to really fully understand these things until they do it themselves, at which point, you know, be quick at making some changes.
Cause yes, exactly. Yeah,
everything,
and sell extra stuff with it, and keep the consistent. Well, I mean, yeah,
exactly.
You know,
and Nick. So, if I go back to last year, I mean, this is the second year we've all been working together.
Yeah.
When we got together last year, what we said we wanted to do was, there's so many hot topics in coffee, but a lot of people can't relate to them.
Yeah.
And actually, the best way to get people to relate is to find businesses that are an example of that topic,
yes.
for example. And so, you know...
Or people that represent that business.
Exactly. So we can learn about, you know, a hot topic actually in action. What does it actually mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so last year it was very successful. Coffee Studies was really popular. And, you know, this year we've got even more content than we had last year. What are some of the highlights of the of Cafe Culture that you're looking forward to?
Well, Coffee Studies obviously is going to be really exciting. That format is super engaging, which was evident last year. Obviously, you're doing the talk. That'll be a highlight. Peak water. I think a lot of people are
interested. You can't see,
in
but I'm blushing.
I'm looking forward to an extension of that program. We've obviously got the Roasters Forum. Yeah, so there's a series of interesting discussions I'm really looking to take part in Coffee Studies. Taylor Brown's talk is going to be interesting, I think.
A lot of the time, those are the stories that are the most fascinating, are the stories of adversity, right?
Yeah. It's at the real personal ones, right?
Yeah.
Which is why Coffee Studies works, because people are so passionate about what they are saying, and because it's industry-based, there's not much need to lay too much context for people to get it, so you can be quite upfront and very to the point.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? And then just generally speaking, there's a lot of community engagement going into it this year with the Core Directive doing their thing. Some people like Coffee and Lewis doing their thing, and obviously the competition.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
No, I think it's what was so inspiring last year was people came to the event and were they felt it was a breath of fresh air.
Yes.
I said, you know, this is exactly what the coffee industry needs.
There was a really strong, palpable sense of energy last year that there hadn't been for a while. It was really, you could really feel it that, you know, there were
people
there.
Of the comments we had about how amazing. Refreshing it was just exactly the result we wanted.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so hopefully, I mean, this year the attendance is up. It's going to be even better.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been wonderful to sit down with you and discuss what we're doing at this year's Cafe Culture. I'll see you at the show.
Wonderful.
You will, absolutely.
Cheers.
Cheers.